you're a fan of elephants, Niall, are you not? We made a documentary about the Pope's elephant.
Absolutely, Hanno. So Hanno, it must be my favourite elephant. I never met Hanno in person, of course, because he died in 1516, I think. the Pope Leo, of course, is not the current Pope Leo. It was Leo X at the time. I love elephants. It's always a treat to see them in a zoo or especially in the wild. Magical creatures, absolutely wonderful.
They are indeed. And if you're into wildlife, especially elephants, you'll know the name Jerry Creighton. Jerry spent decades working closely with elephants at Dublin Zoo. These days, he's the driving force behind Global Elephant Care, an organisation focusing on advancing the welfare and management of elephants around the world. Well, he just happens to be back in Dublin at the moment, and during the week he popped in to say hello and he had a chat with myself and Richard.
I've been extremely busy. Certainly when I call my company Global Elephant Care, I named it correctly. I've been to Brazil, Lima, in Peru, Nanjing, China. China is very interesting. It's, economically and in a lot of ways, there's a lot of changes. But elephants are still a species that need a lot of help in that country. So I went to Nanjing Zoo, and Nanjing Zoo is a very progressive zoo with a young director there that's very keen to do things correctly for elephants. So we were there. I'm working on a design for a very dynamic habitat for the elephant star there. And I also held a workshop for elephant carers from China. There were 60 turned up. I'll be back out there again soon. We need to help them. We need to guide them. You know, it's a cultural change that's needed there. A lot of animals of many different species in China, you either eat them or you wear them, respectfully. It's a big population. And obviously, we have to create a wind of change. And certainly with elephants, which traditionally in zoos were very much props for shows and things like that. So
yeah, just remind people what your company does.
Yes, my Global Elephant Care, obviously after working in Dublin Zoo for many years as operations manager and then obviously running the elephant program, I was being sent away by the zoo to help elephants all around the world, but that wasn't sustainable and I wanted to go and do it far much more. So I set up Global Elephant Care. So my company goes to elephant programs both in the wild, in zoo situations, safari, sanctuaries, to look at the best optimum care for elephants, to look at how we can create training for staff, training for elephants. The training I do for elephants is not any kind of circus-like training. It's training for veterinary access. I just showed Richard outside an elephant recently I trained in the UAE only last week who had damaged the end of his tusk, which is very common occurrence for elephants. And after four training sessions, I showed Richard a video. I trained him to present his tusk out towards me through a training wall, and I was able to shave off a little piece off the end to stop the crack going further up. Training them for blood draws, for foot care, for veterinary access. They're big animals, they need care, so you can't just rack up one day and hope to take an injection or take a blood out of their ear.
No, I'm sure you can't. Just out of curiosity, is it tusk like a human tooth? Is there a nerve
correct.
In there?
Correct. It's a pulp line. If you look with African elephants, but the male and female African have the tusk. Asians only have, the males have them with a sulcus or a very strong nerve with a blood line that passes into the tusk. The Africans, they have it, but male and female have tusks and it can be very nerve sensitive. So you have to be very careful where you cut or x-ray. You'd have to x-ray and check. But I knew where to go with this one. Asian, the females, the tushes, they're small little tusks, but they don't actually have a pulp line, so they regularly break them. But they're different. But it's an incisor tooth. That's what it is.
Now, I know Richard is dying to talk to you. So, Richard, we'll hand over the conch to you.
Jerry, you speak elephantese, elephant language. Are there two languages, two main types of elephants, the Asians and the Africans? Are they different languages or are they the same language?
No, they're very similar. A lot of their elephants, the language is obviously communication. They have a frequency and sounds that they transmit are different that we don't hear. But also you have these high-pitched squeaks and screams and growls, almost like. So they have quite a range of vocalizations that would signal alarm or signal comfort. Like, it's amazing when I'd be doing the feed and you would hear this like almost like it's this long drum roll. And that's contentment to let you know I'm really enjoying this process. Off you go, keep going. Or you would see when there would be panic or drama in the herd. But there's a huge amount of body language which is very, very important for elephants.
And you understand that body language.
Absolutely.
So when you go in the morning to the elephant enclosure, you're able to say, oh, son's a bit off form today, or your man is a bit angry or this kind of thing. Can you?
There's many ways you can do that, particularly the family. Like, if there's a stress or anything that's upsetting the family, you will see them really, really close together. And, you know, sometimes we would look back on the night cameras and see, but did anything cause an upset? And it could be simple, something that, you know, that, like a, an argument in the house over a piece of browse, or just, a, you know, one animal trying to be more dominant to the other. So they have a wide range of very unique socializations, and that, you know, to bring comfort to the herd, to protect the herd. But for me, the body language is so easy to read with elephants. You would see the ears flap really, you know, energetically when they're excited, and, you know, you hear these high, it's amazing, like, you know, 6-7 ton bull elephant, and it's really like a screeching sound. I actually have some sounds that we could listen to and you could hear at one point and even include them, but it's an amazing sound. And yeah, you know so much from their body language. They don't, they communicate, obviously olfactory, using smell and fecal matter and urine, passes on a lot of communication on health status, sexual reproduction, age, bull, female, whatever stage of life they are. So they use a lot of communication from that. But it's amazing to see, and particularly some of the magical moments I've witnessed, or lucky enough to witness, like the birthing moment, the excitement as new life stumbles to the floor and the sand floor, and to see them all gather around, and they pushing in these young females to witness this unique moment where the learnt behaviours are going to secure the herd's future. The matriarch pushing her daughter in, watch, learn. These unique focalizations that happen around this birth are so powerful. And then I've seen the young bulls being pushed outside when this happens. They've nothing to offer. You're a bull, you stay away, you're clumsy, get out of the way. So the structure and organization and the vocalization and the communication is so important to elephant society. I mean, this empathy and this gentleness that you witness, you see them touching one another, comforting one another, you know, offering care, sleeping together, young females and males having to have that skin touch, you know, for security. So not unlike ourselves in many, many ways.
So when Lucy Baines in her research says that it's terribly important to understand trauma and stress in elephants, how important changes can be and the effects they can have, not just on the few individuals concerned, but even on their descendants. This is the case.
Exactly. Like, it's so important to understand our society and what dictates how they live, and like the interference that animals are getting, you know, particularly elephants, like for example, in the home range country in India, with railroads going through their land, the human elephant conflict, domination of the landscape by humans is a huge problem. Everywhere they go now, there's electric fences. So the elephants are having to adapt and try to change their behaviour to survive, like to find new foraging grounds, or being chased away with people using, you know, rockets and firearms and everything. So it's becoming a very complicated life for elephants. You know, obviously there's still certain parts of Africa where they're doing okay, but I mean, every 15 minutes of every day there's an African elephant killed for ivory. The human elephant threat, you know, is... So they're having to adapt, and the matriarch is having to have a tougher life than ever, because she's got to make decisions in the wild now that could significantly impact on her herd. And that's why she's got to make the right decisions, and she has to have that memory and that detail that, you know, I can't go walking for 4 hours if there's a baby just born in the herd, because the baby being exposed to, you know, incredibly difficult terrain or being out in the heat for long periods of time could jeopardize that. So she's got to think of, where can I go? That's a shorter journey. She's got to assess all the family that's around her. And that's what they do. They, based on what's going on in the herd, they make the correct decisions. And that leads on to, like, what I'm doing, and some of the work I'm doing globally is that, like, traditionally, you know, we would have our elephants in zoos in human care, and a lot of love and a lot of care, but we would put the food in the same place every day, and you know, that's pretty repetitious and pretty boring for an exciting, intelligent animal with the von Econome or spindle neuron in the brain. So now what I do, and what I'm doing with, like, for example, in the UAE, where you have 17 hectares for these elephants, so the matriarch comes out in the morning, and I empower her to make the decision. Well, she doesn't know where the food is. She doesn't know where the resources are. We bring in machinery like massive JCBs to make very significant topography changes. So we take them into the back of house area for a while, and they come out, and there was hills where they weren't yesterday, and she has to go, Do I go left? Do I go right? Do I go over the hill to find the resources? We constantly present cognitive challenges that, okay, she goes left and she might walk for a couple of kilometres because that's how big the habitat is. And then the resources are very scarce. And what I've seen them do, which is fantastic, I've actually done this and tested it where I'd have hay net. African elephants really like to feed high. And you would see her dropping the hay for the baby. She would assess, well, there's not an awful lot of food there now. It's best I feed the younger animals.
Well, now, she's the chief executive of the herd.
Yeah, she's the decision maker.
Now, do they all bow to her? She decides everything.
She decides everything. She decides conflict interests. You know, she stops conflict. She mitigates in conflict. She offers support. She offers guidance in the birthing process. She sends out the young bulls when it's time for them to leave the herd, you know, because of to make sure to ensure that there's no inbreeding and they get the chance to live the fission-fusion lifestyle and go off and manage young bulls. And everything is, you know, we're learning so much about them. Like, we used to even think that the bulls were historically were on their own. They don't be on their own. They live in massive groups of 20, 30 boys, hang out together. But they also need as much structure in their life as the females. When young bulls go, they have to have adult bulls. They have to have role models that they can aspire to be in. There was a case in India a few years ago where a couple of young bulls that had been in a sanctuary that were kind of looked after because they had lost their mothers at a young age, and they were released out together. They were all around 10, 14 years old. And they were actually bullying the rhinos and they're trying to attempt to mate rhinos because they were and dominate the rhino population. So immediately what they had to do was bring in a couple of the bulls from a translocated from an older area that were much more older. They immediately calmed them down. They immediately settled them down and showed them how to behave. So it shows the intelligence of these animals and this decision-making process, the lives that they have to live. You know, it's all based on being calculated risks and doing the right thing for the integrity of the herd.
Now, I remember when the Dublin Zoo had females and you needed a bull, and a bull was bought, I think, from Chester.
Correct.
Now, can you, the dynamics of his arrival in Dublin Zoo,
yes,
they built a separate house for him and everything, and it was thought that there would be a break between, he would be on his own all the time, and but it didn't turn out like that. Is it true that they all went up to his house and slept with him every night?
That's right. Well, you see, one of the key things that we did was that we knew this bull upperly. We knew he was a very social bull. We learned about his social skills and his history. And knowing about the animal's history, then you can plan its future. So Upperly was very sociable, a wonderful bull to hang out with, a wonderful bull for young bulls to gravitate to him. But I was thinking at the time, I said, I went back to the elephant's biology. I said, okay, 9 times out of 10 elephants meet each other in the wild by their fecal matter. But they drop their dung on the ground.
Yeah.
And it's as good as a text message for us. Yeah. What they do is the males will come along, they will find a load of dung, they will be able to touch and smell it and know that that's a sexually active female or one that's just had a calf or it's other bulls. In fact, and this is an amazing thing about nature, they will be able to come back after years and smell fecal matter from their family herd and know it's their family and not go into that herd to stop, you know, inbreeding
incest and
genetics. Like, isn't that incredible? So I tapped into that information. I said, wow, well, that's fascinating. So when Upperly came, we had sent the feces to Chester Zoo of our females and we got Upperly's dung sent over.
Mm-hmm.
So our females were able to smell before they had a visual of them. They were able to smell and say, oh, there's a new guy in town.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very normal. This is how they would encounter bulls. Mm-hmm. And vice versa, Upperly got to smell the fecal matter. Mm-hmm. Ah, these girls are ready. There's reproductively active females here. This is a win-win situation. Mm-hmm. So to do the olfactory introduction first, not only prepared them psychologically and physically, it made the introduction so much easier. So the day Upperly came, we took him out of his crate. He had been trained into the crate. Interestingly enough, we'd done cortisol testing. Before he got in the crate, cortisol was perfect. When he travelled in the crate, cortisol was perfect. When he came out, the only elevation was when he was introduced to the female. So that was natural because we wanted to prove that we had trained him correctly with the Chester Zoo team to allow him to travel, you know, on his terms, with using kindness as the key. And within hours of him arriving in Dublin Zoo, he was in with the herd. But we're talking about matriarchs and their decisions. One of the most beautiful things I seen was, again, there was a young female, you know, Anak, in the herd that had never been really around an adult bull. And Dina, the matriarch, she went over towards Upperly, distracted him, backed into him, which is a submissive pose, backed into him, guided him away from the rest of the herd for a few minutes, let him see that everything is okay, like I'm the lead female here, and then she brought in the other females over.
Or was she afraid that he might select one of the others rather than her? Maybe looking after her own patch, was she?
Looking after her own patch, but it was also to show the younger female elephants that this guy is approachable. You know, it was a tactic. It was a strategy to get him on his side and let him be comfortable around, you know, her. And then she would admit out these wonderful sounds and vocalizations. And then you just see these amazing things. Looking up what I'm doing now, I'm training again, as I say, the elephants in a line for positive reinforcement training. I had two or three elephants last week in the training stalls, training them to present their feet for foot care, their ears for blood draws, a body wash, all that kind of stuff. And I'm watching these younger females outside. And they're looking at it saying, the next day, I want to get in on that. The next morning when I went in for training, they were waiting in the state training stalls where their mothers and their aunts and they were the day before, because it was a learned behaviour. Let's hang out in there. Good things happen when you're in there. You get extra food, you get extra treats. And it was amazing. So it's like an adaptation from the wild. But yeah, like we done things differently in Dublin for the elephants. And it was a wonderful programme and still is a wonderful programme. Like there was a couple of things that happened then. Obviously, Yasmin and went away to with her daughter to Cincinnati Zoo. And that's actually got some criticism recently, but that's not completely wrong, because the unbreakable bond in elephant society is the mother and daughter. And Yasmin and her daughter, we could see from a few years ago that they were breaking into micro groups, which is very, very normal. You know, so the mother and daughter is the key part of elephant society, not the sisters. Yeah. And they went off there, and now they formed a new breeding group that will resonate throughout North America and show how elephants live as a family. And then the Dublin family will rebuild and build on again. So very positive things happening. And yeah, so it's just great to be able to see them and learn more from them, their complexity. You know, it's really interesting, you know, when you see, you know, this learned behaviours, it's all about the integrity of the family. Pass down the knowledge, pass down the information, pass them to ensure that everything has it. So, as I say, how it's evolving and how I've evolved and what I want to do is when she, there's no point in just saying she is a matriarch, because a matriarch makes a lot of conscientious decisions for the integrity of the herd. So in human care, give her that choice. Give her that choice to make them decisions, and they will resonate towards her. Because, okay, and you can actually see them without being anthropomorphic. Let's follow the matriarch. Let's see what she's going to do. Rather than just saying, here's a pile of food, go on out there and feed. Complexity, different, destination, motivation for movement. That's what I preach. Give the elephant a purpose, a reason, a meaningful life to go out there, to make decisions. Where do I go? How do I problem solve? How do I figure this out? This resonates right through the family. And then you have a real reason for saying, yes, we're finally starting to realise that we can keep these elephants in human care, that they do have a future in human care, and that we can protect them.
So you believe they have?
Absolutely.
Now, in the zoos generally, as you describe the elephants, they are equivalent to great apes in the sophistication of their societies. Are there any other animals in that league? Lions, tigers, cats, whatever?
Pack animals, there is some interesting families, like wolf complex is a very complex society, you know, with a hierarchical system. African hunting dogs is, you know, the coordination and the strategies for selective feeding. And you know, the African hunting dogs will send guys on 10 kilometres ahead as they run the chase to them to pick up the chase. So it's not quite as complex as what the elephant society is. They don't show the exact levels of tenderness, of emotional, you know, reflection of death, mourning death, celebrating life. You know, elephants seem to be that little step ahead. And it is because it's about, you know, this century of looking after the family and making sure. It's fascinating to watch them. And, you know, it's just so glad that we are changing, because remember, for so long, like, these were taken away as neonatals and they were kept in zoos and other places and without this learning ability. And then they were given birth and the babies were dying. They had to learn how to be mothers. They had to learn how to be reproductively active bulls. I mean, I've seen it in Dublin Zoo when Upoli was mating the females. The young bulls were called in. They were standing around their father. So these unique sights and sounds and vocalizations. Jerry can't teach them anything about doing that, but the bull could. And that's why Dublin Zoo, when it came to elephant welfare, done a tremendous job globally to influence how elephants are kept.
Now, you mentioned death there, it's a dreadful subject, but the old matriarch, does she reign until the day she dies? Or are there challengers coming up saying, when you're too old, you're past it, you're useless? And does this have, what goes on? Is there an internal revolt within these things?
Yeah, great question. But generally, no, because you don't. She's enough to do with minding the integrity of her. She's very rarely challenged. And generally, it's a hereditary title. Because her daughter would spend so much time close to her when she's making these critical decisions for the integrity of the herd, she inherits the title then as matriarch.
But will the mother accept that she'll give her hand over to her for a while and let her be a joint matriarch?
Generally, the matriarch would die, or she would get very old, where the decision-making process... You know, elephants get 7 sets of teeth in their lifetime. Yeah. They're looking for food for 18 hours a day. But when that last sets of teeth die, if they're not killed by poaching or killed for any other reason, they starve. Yeah, that's the reality of nature. Yeah, that's the terrible thing about nature. Now, they will try support one another and they'll offer food, but generally that's what happens. But no, it's a very distinct position and role that the daughter follows. A mature daughter would stay with the mother and she would learn all that, and then it's handed down. The only other one that's similar in terms of, which is interesting, is the great apes, which is the orangutan. The orangutan has the longest relationship between mother and young in the animal kingdom. And that's because they're solitary. They're a solitary ape. They're an arboreal solitary ape. So they have to hand all the knowledge down. So a young orangutan will stay with its mother for 9, 10, 11 years before it moves off, because it's an arboreal solitary lifestyle. So before it goes off to school or goes off to life, it has to know everything it needs for survival, for dealing with situations, for being around other orangutans. They are the true, you know, solitary ape. They don't really live in large groups, where you have the chimpanzee and the gorilla. You have complexity, you have structure, you have hierarchy, you have roles, you have, you know, definition. Everybody knows where they are. Orangutans are quite different. So that's why they have the longest relationship after humans and elephants, females in the animal kingdom. So it's very interesting stories.
So the things we hear about elephants, you know, having grief and all this kind of thing, it's very understandable after what you've said now.
Exactly.
Because when a matriarch dies, the effect on everyone must be enormous. All the wealth of information and knowledge and memory and everything else that go, and apart from the affection and so on and so forth,
and not
that's
just
all
that,
gone.
Yeah, but not just the matriarch. I mean, the home, any, particularly the females, as they say, there's a little bit different, and it's really interesting. When I seen the calves being born at Dublin Zoo, like and other zoos that I've worked with, you would see the young male elephant, and the next day he'd be 100 yards away from his mother. You would never see that with the females. They're always right close together. But they
explain that. Why?
Because they're biologically programmed to leave the herd. And you see that from a very young age.
But they're to be 8 years old before they do that.
Yeah, but you can see that they just don't have the same closeness as the female. Mm. The love and the attention, if you know, is still there from the mother. And there's no doubt it is a love. It's a very affectionate, kindness, you know, empathetic reason to keep them safe. But they you can just see the boys go off. Off they go. You don't ever see that with the females. They always stay close to mom. But yeah, like, I mean, they have been documented coming back to where a matriarch or a senior member of a herd died, coming back the following year, almost on an annual pilgrimage to touch and show respect to the bones. And this has been well documented. Like, it's actually been seen that they would pass and they would know that this is a carcass or this is a bone or a skeleton from an elephant that was previously a member of the herd. And they would, you know, they would be around there and you would see this. They would be all calm and then they would leave after kind of almost paying their respects. Like, it's an incredible phenomenon with them.
And the
whole herd will do it. The whole herd will do it. So it's and this is the thing that the more, this is why I'm so excited about what I'm doing with my company, because the more I'm allowing them to and promoting them acting naturally in zoos and being given the choices, the opportunity, the cognitive challenges, control over their day, the more beautiful behaviour you're seeing and the more we're learning and understanding this species, because they need our help, they need our care, but we can only give them the best care when we fully understand their psychological, their physiological and their emotional needs. And the one thing that I preach to all the zoos I go to, I said, if you want to be a successful animal carer, be it for elephants, orangutans, chimpanzees, gorillas, be non-existent in their life. And a lot of key, you know, elephant carers and animal carers, they kind of almost take offence. But what do you mean by that? I says, it shouldn't be because you walk by and you rattle your keys that the elephant or the animal, oh, something good is going to happen now because, or maybe the keeper's going to feed me or maybe the keeper's going to let us in. Then you fail miserably. You go out in the morning, you be an architect of the animal's day. You give them the biologically appropriate resources they need, the opportunities for foraging and feeding, and become non-existent in their life. And that's what I'm doing. I go to places now, again, like Aline. I watch these elephants for 5 hours. They don't care about Jerry. That's a success. I would love to see a day that we don't have to have elephants in human care, but I don't believe that's anytime soon. But in the meantime, following their biology, following their society, following how they live, they have a future. But we got to do it right.
I believe you have a film coming out. I heard a rumour.
Well, an elephant told me this.
It's going to be on Netflix towards the end of the year.
We're hoping next year. Yeah, we're doing some work recording with elephants around the world and working with Moondance Productions that produced the Zoo TV show. So watch this space for now.
Oh, I certainly will. Thank you, Jerry.
My pleasure. My pleasure as always.
You really like Jerry Crichton, don't you?
Who doesn't? He's Mr. Elephant, you know.
Elephant, I'm sure he'd be delighted to hear that.
But he speaks with them with
passionate.
That's exactly it. You can tell how much he loves elephants and he's spent his career around them and he still loves elephants more than ever. And he just conveys it in such an enthusiastic and accessible way.
Yeah, and he's upfront and honest about how they were cared for and how we should move forward, you know. That's what I like.
It's about learning from that experience.
Absolutely, 100%. You can't change the past. Anyway, that's all we have time for tonight. Niall, thank you very much indeed. Visit the website anytime you like. RTE.ie/Mooney. We'll do it all again next week. Until then, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.
Email Mooney@RTE.ie.